Well, morning, everybody.
Morning.
Hey, my name's Greg Cox. I am an alcoholic and an addict. And my sobriety date is July 27th of 2006. And, you know, just a little bit about me. I was born and raised in a little town south of here called Moultrie. Maybe some people have heard of it. It's just above Tallahassee. I grew up there till I was 18 years old. And I had somewhat of a normal family, you know, mother, father. I had four older sisters. My youngest sister is actually 10 years older than I am. So I was, you know, spoiled rotten from the beginning. You know, can't deny that. I was pretty involved in sports and everything in high school. Had normal childhood somewhat. Talk a little bit more about that. As soon as I turned 18 years old, I went to a Navy recruiter and I said, take me as far away from here as you possibly can. And, you know, he did. He sent me to San Diego to go to basic. So I was pretty happy about that. And from then I was able to travel and see quite a bit and experience quite a bit from there. I was in the Navy for 11 years. I did get a chance to see Panama Desert Storm and, you know, a couple of those wonderful places like that. I met my first wife somewhere around 92. I got married around that time frame in 94. And we had two kids together. And before I knew it, she wasn't exactly the most responsible person in the world. So I ended up being, let's say, a single dad at the end of it with full custody of the kids. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. Talk about being in the military. And if anybody knows it, you have sea duty, you have shore duty in the military. And when I went to my first 5 years, I was in sea duty. And I won't really go into what I did in the military or anything like that. But first 5 years, I was on sea duty. Then I went to shore duty. And that's where you don't go overseas. You don't go on deployment. You don't go on tours. And so I was an instructor then. And when I went into sea duty, I was actually a single man. By the time I came out of those 3 years, I was a single dad of two kids with single sole custody. So, you know, I ended up staying in the military after that, but it was a little rough. So I did stay in till about 1999 is when I got out in April, and it was a tough decision to leave. But you know, like I said, being a single dad, every time I had to go overseas, I had to leave the kids with either my mother or sister, somebody who was well out of town, you know. And my older son, Bryant, he was about to turn four, starting kindergarten. So, you know, I kind of had to make a choice there. What am I going to do? Am I going to, you know, I can't just keep bouncing them around, you know, going to school. So I decided to go ahead and get out of the military, which I did. And I kind of regret it, but then I don't regret it. So I did get a chance to go to college, you know, and do design engineering. And finished that up, went there. Then right before I got out of the military, I met a woman who would be my second wife. I've been married. My second wife. And we ended up getting married in, let's see, 2001. And we have two kids together. The thing about my second wife is she ended up being a pretty strung out crack addict after a while. And kind of hard to say, but after my youngest son was born, who's Nicholas. He was born in 2001, and by that, he was born in November of 2001. By March 2002, my second wife was now gone. You know, she was in crack houses, and now I never saw her. And eventually, we got divorced, and I got custody of two. So, you know, here I am, a dad of four kids, you know, with sole custody, and just kind of looking like, you know, How'd I get here? You know, and I couldn't quite understand that, but they just kind of went along with it. I did, during that time that I met my wife, or my second wife, I was introduced to the 12-step program, but it wasn't through AA. It was through, everybody's heard of Al-Anon? This is called Narnon, which is for families of alcoholics and addicts. And, So they practice the same 12 steps that we do, change two words in it. Basically, supposed to be the same way. And so I got in that. But, you know, one thing I didn't really say was, you know, during this time, all the drinking and drugging that I'm doing, you know, probably didn't help out. You know, so I can't really practice a 12-step program when, you know, something there when I'm drinking and drugging myself, which I failed to tell anybody about that. Going a little bit further about me, I did eventually meet another lady once I got sober, and I'll come back to that a little bit, in 2007, and ended up being my third wife. And so we are now married. We've been married now for 9 years. We're very happily married. She actually adopted my two younger ones. My two older ones are a little too old, but she adopted my two younger ones. And we're very happily married. A little bit of demographics. I, of course, grew up in Moultrie. I lived in Jacksonville, Florida for about 20 years, which is actually where I got sober and where all my trouble started. I lived in Nashville, Tennessee for a little over two years. Actually, I lived in Chattanooga before Nashville. I lived in Chattanooga for about 6 years. Then I moved to Nashville. And then I moved here in 2015. I've been here ever since. And, you know, glad to be a part of this group here. I haven't really found a good one since I've been here, but I've joined this club, I don't know, since back in October, so I've been coming to this group, and it's really, you know, I call this one my home group now, which I'm proud to do so. And just kind of bounce around from rooms and trying to find the right one, just going from there. Going back to my childhood a little bit, I did have somewhat of a normal childhood, my father was an abusive father. He was an alcoholic, I would say an alcoholic. He was never diagnosed in that way, and it wasn't a daily drunk thing, but there were times when he did get drunk, and when he would just beat the living shit out of my mother and my four sisters, but he would never touch his little boy. You know, and so I had the chance of watching him be abusive to everybody except for me. And, eventually, you know, so it kind of kept me in this fear growing up, or, you know, what's my dad going to do next? You know, and don't get me wrong, I still had a closeness with my dad. We went fishing and we did stuff like that together. You know, I played sports. He was always interested in sports. We watched football together. You know? But I still had that fear in me. And that fear kind of drug along through the years. When I was 14, my father did pass away of a massive heart attack. It was a cardiac arrest down in Florida. And I tell you, when he passed away, where I should have been sad and mournful, I was actually happy, because I didn't have to live in the fear of what's going to happen, you know, from day to day with that life. But during those years, I knew that I always had that fear inside of me, you know, that I would follow through the rest of my life, and I would always be this type of person that I can't see where I'm equal to somebody. I have to be either above somebody or I'm below. So I always have to have an upper hand. You know, that's kind of the way that I feel. And I've always kind of felt that way in my head. And shortly before my father died, I heard somebody speak at one time, and I won't mention names, but he had talked about when he was a kid, and I can follow this the same. He saw this movie that came on TV. It's called The Exorcist. And, you know, when you're a kid years old, and you're about 10 or so, that's traumatizing, man. It is. And it didn't scare me to my knees, man. It scared me out of religion. And I grew up in Southern Baptist, but was never really forced too much to go to church. But, you know, I was forced here and there, and I hated it, just like any other kid hates sitting in church. And, it scared me right out of it. And I got this idea in my mind that, you know what? If I don't believe in a God or God, then there's no such thing as the devil either. So that's my warped thinking. You know, it's all fuckered up. And so right there, in my early age, I became an atheist. I didn't want to believe in God or anything of that nature. I had don't rely on anything but me. And, you know, that's a pretty sad shape to be. Ended up making it through high school. Nothing major there. Did start drinking in high school, but it was just recreational drinking. Did smoke some pot, of course. Nothing really heavy, nothing to brag about, so to speak. But, you know, when I drank, I got sick. You know, that was a kind of a lightweight. Now, graduated high school, sent away, joined the military. When I got to my unit where I was, it's kind of hard to explain, but as a team, we work together and we play together. And that means that playtime with a group of military guys like this is what trouble I can get into by drinking the night before is good discussion for the next day. You know, so I put you out a window in a car, man, that's a good discussion. You know, and what women we picked up the night before. You know, and so it's somewhat a rowdy bunch, but the thing about it is, you know, that's where I really learned how to drink more. But I also found that I was a lightweight, somewhat. I mean, I could keep up with the best of them, I guess, for the most part. But never really liked drinking. I never really cared for the taste of beer or alcohol, but I liked the effect, of course. You know, I'm sorry, alcohol made me about that much taller and bulletproof. And, you know, I like that it eased me up a little bit where I could talk a little bit easier and I could hang out a little bit easier and fit in a little bit better. And it was a good thing that I did drink at the time that I did, because if I had not been, although the guys that I were with were really good, tight-knit, if I hadn't drank like that and like them, then I wouldn't have fit in. You know, I'd have been an outcast somewhat. I mean, they would have been accepting. If I would have gone to them and said, hey, guys, I got a problem, you know, they would have said, oh, man, we'll help you. But eventually, I still would have been an outcast, you know, and just wouldn't fit in with the rest of them. So I kept drinking, and in 1993, I remember it was in October, one of my buddy, AJ, gave me these three pills. He said, hey, Boxer, he said, here, take some of these. And I was still in the military, you know. And, you know, so was he. So I took these little things, and they're called Rapid Action. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of them, but you could buy them over the counter in Little Champs. And I took three of those things, and next thing I know, man, the hairs on the top of my hair, you know, started standing up, and I was like, man, my lungs just opened up. I was smoking. I could just smoke like a banshee and drink, and the next thing I know, I'm talking just a storm, man. I mean, because I was never much of a talker. You know, they're just looking, oh, you know, he's partying, you know. That's just the way he is. But I was talking, yapping, you know, and I like that. You know, that was a little bit more courage for me. And you know, they heard the story of old Dr. Alcoholic Addict, and what's it called now? Acceptance is the answer story. And you know, how he mentioned at one point how he was talking and found that he was repeating himself, saying the same things over and over, just because of what he was taking was yapping him up so much. And that's kind of the same situation I was in. And but I found that these little pills that were called, we called them the trots. They're called foxtrots. That's what we called them. And they were just pure ephedrine, guanfacine, right? And they call them foxtrots because if you ever seen these big military planes that carry the fuel so other airplanes can fuel in flight, they're called in-flight refuelers, right? Foxtrots. So it makes total sense. And so I held it together during my military career, ended up getting out in 1999, and everything there was legal. I did nothing illegal, besides the case of taking too many pills at a time. But when I got out of the military, that's when I really started pretty heavy. And about this time is when I had gotten involved with my second wife, who I mentioned turned into a crack addict eventually. And but at that time, I started drinking really heavily, and I was popping these pills like dozens at a time, you know. And it just progressed and progressed, as probably a lot of you can understand. You know, it just kept going and going. Next thing you know, all those days that I had at partying and that were good and such good stories and everything to talk about, you know, those were way out of reach by this point. And, you know, so now I was with my wife and pretty much isolating myself with pills and alcohol. And so, you know, all those good times that I had, you know, I want to reach out and grab them and bring them back in, but they're gone. You know, and I'll never get them back. And I never realized that at the time. And plus all the other issues that I had going on and this old fuckered up mind of mine that, you know, I never will. But I never realized all this stuff. You know, I just thought it was normal. I mean, nobody ever came up and told me, hey, man, you got something wrong with you. You know, so I never thought anything of it. You know, how I feel inside. And always had that void. There's a reason that I'm probably married three times. It's because I got a big void inside of me that I think has to be filled by somebody. You know, whether it be friends or alcohol or women. And so I always had to have that void filled by something else. And a little bit later, I found out what that void was supposed to be filled with. But my wife at that time did start going out and with her addiction. I held it together during my military years. I kind of missed this, but because I was a single dad and doing all that, I held it together, and I kept myself to going out and drinking and partying one night a week, and that was always on Fridays, man. And just on Fridays. I mean, that was the golden rule. And I was able to stay like that for quite a few years, you know. And I had a babysitter scheduled right there on time, man. She was 5 minutes late, I was roaring, you know, because of that time, because little, there wasn't paying attention there, but my whole week now was revolving around that one night. Everything else didn't really matter so much except for that one night that I got to go drinking. And so when I did get in the military, then it started escalating. And when my second wife decided to go to, you know, use a crack cocaine, I kind of hit somewhat of a bottom, although I was drinking and popping a lot of pills and everything then and really getting out of control. Started going to R-9, like I mentioned, and was introduced to the 12-step program there. But it was kind of like a stepping stone for me for a 12-step program, if you want to call it that. And I was drinking, drugging, and I guess when you're working steps 1, 2, and 3 and you're drinking and drugging, they kind of don't count. You know, when she went out, she was gone by that time. She was in crack houses, and eventually I just said, you got to go. And she had no objection. She said, okay, bye. And so she was gone, moved. She actually moved up here to Atlanta. I was still in Jacksonville. And never saw too much of her after that. But in Naranon, now I've got 4 boys that I'm trying to raise. And my addiction and my alcoholism is getting really out of control at this point. I had already started isolating quite a bit, like I mentioned. And the behavior started. Next thing I know, I'm popping so many pills. I mean, I would pop probably 100 in a night. I mean, yeah, no shit. I'd probably pop 100 of these a night. You know, and I don't know why I'm still alive. There's no way. That stuff speeds up your heart. You know, it's like snorting cocaine. I've never done cocaine. You know, but this stuff is kind of potent. It's what they make meth out of. It's what I learn now. You know, popping all these pills and drinking like I was, and the isolation and trying to raise 4 boys, who I feel for them, you know, because they got the brunt of it. I still managed to do it and keep it together, held a job, until it just got too much and to the point where I was staying up for days at a time. Anybody, I guess, who's done cocaine or any kind of speed or anything like that, you know that you take enough of it, you can stay up and stay up. So I would drink, get drunk. I could sober up, get drunk again, sober up, drunk again, and for 3 days or more. I don't know how many in a row. I can remember 3 at least, and never sleep. I can get drunk and sober and drunk and sober, man. I mean, I got the life here, living like that. But where's my real responsibilities going? You know, where they should be. Like, whoosh, down. So, you know, eventually, like I said, the behaviors, and they started getting the best of me. I did end up losing a job that I had when I first got out of college because of the alcohol and drugs and just lack of responsibilities, really. And with that, so, you know, while I was out unemployed in that time, I did sober up a little bit on my own and got it, got myself together. But that didn't last too long. I mean, it's a progressive disease and it doesn't just go away. And so neither do I. And so I went back onto that. And next thing you know, I don't exactly know what happened at the whole story because I'd been awake for days at a time. And if you ever done that, you know, your mind just kind of out there. But I had decided that I was losing my home. Everything was in jeopardy. And I said, I'd been awake for at least a couple of days drinking, drugging. And I said, I'm leaving. So I packed the kids in the car that I had at that time and I was headed out, man. And, I blacked out with all four of the boys in the car. And, so I don't know a whole lot of it except when I came to and I was behind the car in handcuffs. And the police are just in there wondering what's going on with this guy. You know, he's because I hadn't been drinking right then. I wasn't drunk, but I had been awake in all this, you know, the behaviors. I've been awake and my mind was gone. And I had managed to get the car over safely, but what my boys told me was I had asked one of them to, hey, grab the wheel real quick. And so he grabbed it, so I was able to get the car stopped. And the only problem with it is that I stopped in the middle of the road, turned everything off and the lights, and it was at a country road, no lights, no houses anywhere. And somebody just happened to run up along me without running into me and killing all of us, and called the police. And so I was actually Baker acted, and one of my many stays that I would end up doing in the psych ward in the hospital. Because they couldn't figure out why did you do what you did? You know, and it's easy to hide taking a bunch of pills. It's not so easy to hide, you know, drinking alcohol, but it is, you know, taking a bunch of pills. At least it wasn't that time. And so I spent time in there, and the first time somebody had ever approached me was a doctor, and I can't remember his name now, but he said, you know, I think you're a liar. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks because, you know, I've always been a good guy. I've always been able to fool everybody all through my life, man. You know, this guy is calling me a liar. And, cause he couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I wasn't telling anybody. And, but eventually I did get out of there, the Baker Act. And, but that still had an effect on me. And, so my disease kept progressing even more so. Talk about the insanity. And eventually I did lose my kids for a while. And that was probably the biggest bottom that I got. And that kind of helped me turn around, but it wasn't the end of all, be it all either. I wish I could say that it was, but it wasn't. And so like I said, many times of being in the psych ward of the hospital and actually spent some time in a halfway house and just doing everything I could to get my kids back because they had really nowhere to go. They were staying with my mother and mother-in-law. Things were really kind of shitty. And I'm really, you know, concerned about where I'm going. But one thing is that when I was in Narnon, I met this guy there who actually was my sponsor. His name was Johnny. And Johnny was my sponsor from 2002 up until he died 2 years ago. And you know, Johnny was always that light in my life that even though I was out drugging and drinking and headed from him, you know, he taught me some of the spiritual principles on this wall over here, you know, that at least introduced me to him, which I had never really, I grew up in the, I knew right from wrong, but I never really knew much of spiritual principles, you know. And, so finally on, it was somewhere around beginning of July, I decided that I'm just going to run away. I'm going to leave everything behind. And I did. And I left. And I ran up to Georgia around Columbus where my sister lived, my older sister. And I stayed with her for a couple of weeks and dried myself out there. And came back down. There was a club that I knew of there in Jacksonville that was a lot like this one, the AA group. And so I went back there and ended up surrendering for the last time, picking up my last white chip. Of course, by this time, you know, I was still homeless, living out of my car and alone. And but I had always had a friend there, or there was a friend there who said, hey, you know, come stay with me. So I did and got back on my feet in there. We started my program recovery. That was right around, I say July 27th of 2006, because that's about the time frame I remember that everything kind of came together, and the date that I could say it is the date that I really came to surrender to it. And I surrendered to this program over here, you know, that changed my life. And like I said, stepping stones. Narnon stepped me up to the point where I was introduced to it. And now, by the time I got to this, got to the rooms, man, I was ready. You know, I had just gone down. It doesn't sound like a lot because I can't tell but so much, you know, in 15, 20 minutes. But, you know, there's a lot more experience in there and a lot more behaviors that are not mentioned that, was part of my life that, just kind of exclamates the craziness that I was going through. And, you know, I'm sure everybody can relate to that. And, finally reaching my what eventually led me to my low that I finally decided to surrender for the last time. But I remember one time laying in there, and I said that I was an atheist, and laying in bed when I was still one of the nights when I was sober, not popping pills, and just saying, you know, if there's a God out there, you know, man, just take me, you know, just stop my heart, just do something, because just laying there and just pain, you know, pain in here, and not knowing anything to do with it. You know, I could talk to somebody about it, but they just couldn't take it away. Nothing could take that pain away. And so that helped me get to where I was. But when I came to the rooms, you know, I took step one, which we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And like I said, I was ready to do that. My life was definitely unmanageable. It was out of control. There was nothing I could do about it. I knew nothing, no more of the steps that I could take within myself. My will got me to where it was, and now it's, you know, I learned through from step to step that my will is what got me where it was. And it was good for what it lasted and got me through life, but it also got me in a lot of trouble. You know, so that's when I came in and I started, it's time to live in the solution. And the solution's in this program. And living these spiritual principles are on the wall here, you know, that I've learned over the years and still learn on a daily basis, at least try to. You know, I am probably, I think that I am a good example of the big book talking about the bottle being a symbol. That I do believe that the bottle for me is a symbol. Cause the problem is not the bottle. You know, I had my problems before I ever picked up a drink or a drug. And when I put that drink and drug down, you know, problems are still there. They don't go away. So, that's where it came to be. And, you know, so how can I come in and, you know, find some strength to pass this? And what's the big book tells me that, you know, well, the whole purpose of this book, and it says right in there, is to help you connect with a power that's greater than you. And, being an atheist for all my life, you know, and wanting to believe in something, but still just too smart for my own good. You know, that's basically what it boiled down to at this point. And, how do I find something that's going to be more powerful than I am? And Narnon really helped me with that. It introduced me that to a point at that time, and this was back in 2002, 2003, that, hey, step two, when you take that, you got to have something higher than you, you know, whether you call it God or whatever. And so by the time I got there in 2006 and was ready, I was at a point where I know what I got to do, so I got to find a power that I can now call God. And that's been a tough journey for me, taking step two. And making step three, I made the decision to turn my will in my life, which I have to do on a daily basis, is turn that over. Knees in the morning, you know, third step prayer. Live in the solution, man. Live in God's will and don't live in my will, because my will is a bunch of shit. You know, and it's going to get me in every, you know, my, right where I don't want to be, where I was before. When I first came in the rooms also, one of the big things that I did was I got really heavy into service work. And this is still down in Jacksonville, Florida, where I got sober. But it just happened to be that my first sponsor there was the president of the club. And the club was going through a bunch of renovation at that time, laying tiles and stuff. So I pretty much lived there at the club doing service work. You know, construction, building up the room, laying tile, redoing the bathrooms, everything. And that kept me out of my head and out of the head that, hey, poor me, my kids are still gone and I don't know how to get them back. And, I found that service work was probably a savior for me, you know, helped me get there. Also during the service work, you know, the fellowship that I started gaining, because I'm meeting everybody as I'm doing this too, you know, and learning everybody, and you know, they're telling me things about that, and I'm able to connect with them. And I talked a lot about God, because every question that I had was about what do you believe? You know, how do you accept this? You know, and because I knew that, you know, that's where I need to go. And the good thing about it is the big book doesn't say anything about, you know, different gods or different. It says you can have your own perception of God, but it still mentions God, like there's only one. There's only one God. You just have a different perception. There's only one God, you know. And so I can believe in that to the point where there is intelligence and something that I could base my faith on. Because faith is the key to my sobriety that has been through the years, is the faith that I have developed. And that's what these 12 steps on this board over here did for me, is not only just get me sober and teach me how to live a better life, but it connected me with God. And, you know, if I can't be thankful for anything more than just that, then, you know, that's fine. I have faith today where I did not have any faith growing up, or any kind of faith when I was out doing, and you talk about the foxhole prayer and mention, you know, not even believing and still reaching out and saying, you know, if there's a God, you know, please take me away. You know, I guess he answered me, because he did something. It took a little while, but that wasn't anything more than just me. That was my will. But, definitely service work, sponsorship. I've had quite a few sponsors through the years. I've also moved 3 times in sobriety. You know, it's kind of rough when you get to one place, you've been there a couple of years, and then you move and get to learn new people. But it's also a good thing, because I got numbers from all over the place, and I do a lot of traveling also. So every time I go traveling, I like to hit a lot of meetings when I go traveling. And I find that, you know, I can always get meetings from wherever, from Oklahoma, or up north, or, you know, even out in California. they have meetings out there too, believe it or not. But it was, honesty, you know, service work, surrender, faith. And that's what brought me to my knees and taught me how to live the right way. At least I try to every day. I am one of those that, you know, I'm never going to have, I think, a perfect day as far as being able to surrender my will and do just God's will, because, I mean, I am a human. Maybe somebody else can do it. I don't know if I can. I've never had a perfect day where I've surrendered my will completely, because I've had good days where, you know, get along with everybody, and I'm the first one to point out something wrong with everybody, you know. And I'll do everybody's inventory. I mean, you need some help. I'll do your inventory. You know, but the thing about it is I love living in my will because, man, you know, I'm used to that I'm used to living in the misery, man. That's what I was doing. I know that all my years. You know what misery I'm talking about. It's, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like, it's warm. You know, it's a good feeling, that misery, the warm, and it's squishy. You know, and it kind of feels real good, you know, when you're wallowing all in it. You know, that's so trying to learn a different way from that. What the program teaches me is stop. Misery is optional. I don't have to choose that way. Misery is optional. Live in the solution. Solution's God to me. Solution's in the program. Solution's in you guys, in the fellowship. Solution's in surrender service work. There's so many different things that this program has to offer. And anybody new coming in, hopefully, you do come in here and get this eventually, like I did. But, you know, it can change your life. It has changed my life. I wouldn't say that my life was such a bad life, because it's not. I have a really great life, even younger. I had some really good years, some really good times. You know, drinking was a really good thing at a time. But the drinking didn't ruin me. You know, I ruined me. My will ruined me. And alcoholism ruined me. And addiction ruined me. And so learning to live a different way by these spiritual principles and trying to practice every day is it's not easy. And, you know, it's something that I have to do, maybe not even on a daily basis, but sometimes even on like on a minute basis. I have to constantly try to turn my will over because I want to grab that son of a bitch every time it's out there. You know, and it rears up and I grab it. I take control of it. But, you know, I tried to throw everything in there as much as I could. I know I've missed a lot of stuff. I mentioned, you know, some of the craziness that I really went through and everything, but I do share in meetings. You know, hopefully, you know, get a chance to talk a little bit more about it during the meetings. But, you know, I can tell you, I do appreciate Johnny asking me for coming up and doing this. I don't feel like I give enough back these days. You know, I haven't had a sponsee, and it's been almost a year now, you know, since I've had a sponsee. And so I kind of get to the point where I'm not giving enough back, you know, not sharing enough, not doing whatever I need to do. So this is a good opportunity for me. You know, a little nervous as shit, you know, still able to come up here and do it. And so thank you, Johnny. And thank you all for listening to me and putting up with me. And I'll turn it over there. Thanks.